sighed. I thought maybe I was just a 17-year-old kid who happened to be in good shape, had gotten lucky drawing an opponent without much side vision, and had been able to harness his worst impulses long enough to survive. Besides, did I want to be the prince in this dark fairy tale? I did not. What I wanted was to get my dog and go home. And home never seemed so distant. We made our slow way back to our cells in Deep Malin. Murph with his shoulder wound, Jaya and Eris, Amit, Iota, Doc Freed, Bolt, Bendo, Measel, Kamet, Double, Stooks with his badly slashed face, Quilly, Akka, unconscious Gully, and me. 16. Except neither Doc Freed nor Gully would be able to fight the next round. Not that they would be accepted, I knew better. They would be placed against opponents who'd slaughter them quicky-quick for the pleasure of Eldin, Petra, and Flight Killer's smattering of subjects. Those who drew Freed and Gully in the next round would, in effect, be given a bye. Nor were Murph and Stooks likely to survive to what would be called in March Madness the Elite Eight. The door at the end of the cell block was opened. I and Amit carried Gully through. Quilly and Freed came next, Quilly basically holding the doc up so he wouldn't have to try walking on his bad leg. Not that Freed was up to much walking. He was in and out of consciousness, chin bouncing on his chest. As we entered Malin, he said something so terrible, so lost, that I will never forget it.
I want my mama.
The gas jet inside the door had fallen out of its hole again and dangled on its metal hose. It had gone out. One of our guards slammed it back into the hole where it belonged and looked at it for a moment as if daring it to fall out. It didn't.
Special dinners tonight, kiddies,
one of the others proclaimed.
Big food and dessert to follow.
We entered our cells. I, Stooks, and I were now enjoying, if that is the word, singles. Quilly carried Freed into his cell, laid him gently on his pallet, then went into the one he shared with Kamet. We waited for the night soldiers to exit with their arms outstretched, causing the cell doors to slam, but they just left, locking the door to the outer world behind them. One bolt, two bolt, three bolt, four. Apparently, as well as big food, we were to be allowed to mingle, at least for a little while. Eris was in Gully's cell, examining his head wound, which was, no need to go into details, horrific. His breath came in irregular rasps. Eris looked up at me with tired eyes.
He'll not last the night, Charlie.
Then she laughed bitterly.
But then none of us will, for it's always night here.
I patted her shoulder and walked back to Iota's cell, which she had elected not to leave. He sat against the wall, wrists on his knees, hands dangling. I sat down beside him.
What the devil do you want? He asked. I'd just as soon be alone, if it please you, that is, your royal fucking majesty.
Speaking low, I said,
if there was a way out of here, a way to escape, would you try it with me?
He raised his head slowly. He looked at me and began to smile.
You just show me the way, my love. Only show me.
What about the others? Those who are able?
The smile widened.
Does royal blood make you stupid, Princey? What do you think?
Chapter 25. A banquet. I receive a visitor. Inspiration doesn't knock.
Who wants to live forever?
1. It wasn't just chunks of half-raw meat for the survivors that night. It was a regular banquet. Percy and two other gray folk, a man and a woman dressed in stained white tunics, rolled in not one cart, but three. They were flanked, fore and aft, by night soldiers, limber sticks at the ready. The first cart contained a huge pot that made me think of the Wicked Witch's kitchen in Hansel and Gretel. Stacked around it were bowls. In the second was a tall ceramic canister and small cups. In the third were half a dozen pies with golden brown crusts. The mingled smells were heavenly. We were killers now, killers who had murdered our fellows, but we were also hungry. And if not for the pair of watching skeletors, I think we would have charged those carts. As it was, we retreated to the open doors of our cells and watched. Double kept wiping his mouth with his arm. We were each given a bowl and a wooden spoon. Percy dipped stew into the rim of each bowl from the pot. It was thick and creamy, real cream, I think, loaded with big chunks of chicken plus peas, carrots, and corn. I had wondered before where the food was coming from, but right then, I only wanted to eat.
"But in your hell,"
Percy said in his rough, dying voice,
"there's more."
From the canister there came a fresh fruit salad, peaches, blueberries, strawberries. Unable to wait, the sight and smell of real fruit made me desperate. I tilted the ceramic cup to my mouth and ate it all, wiping the juice from my chin and licking my fingers. I could feel my whole body welcome it, after a steady diet of meat and carrots, and more meat and carrots. The pies were divided up 15 ways, none for Gully, whose eating days were done. There were no plates for the pie, so we used our hands. Iota's slice was gone even before the last portions had been handed out.
"Apple,"
he said, and crumbs flew from his lips.
"And damn good."
"Eat well, kiddies,"
one of the night soldiers proclaimed, then laughed. "For tomorrow we die," I thought, hoping it wouldn't be tomorrow, or the next day, or the day after that. I still had no idea how we were going to get out of here, even if Percy did know a way from the official's room. What I knew was that I wanted it to be before the second round of the Fair One, where I might, very likely, be pitted against Jaya. There wouldn't be anything fair about that. The guards and kitchen crew left, but for the time being, the cell doors remained open. I dug into the chicken stew. It was delicious. Oh my God, so delicious. "Yummy for my tummy," the birdman would have said, in days of yore when we were sitting on our bikes outside the Zip Mart and eating Twinkies or Slim Jims. I looked next door and saw Stooks gobbling, holding his hand to the side of his face to keep the chicken gravy from oozing out of his cheek. There are images that will always stay with me from my time in Deep Malene. That's one of them. When my bowl was empty, I'm not ashamed to say I licked it clean, just like Jack Spratt and his wife, I picked up my slice of pie and bit into it. Mine was custard rather than apple. My teeth struck something hard. I looked and saw a stub of pencil poking out of the custard. Wrapped around it was a small scrap of notepaper. No one was looking at me. They were all concentrating on their meals, so different from our usual fare. I slipped the paper and pencil under Hamie's palate. He wouldn't mind. With the cells open, we were free to congregate for post-banquet chats. Iota crossed to my cell. Amit joined him. One on each side, but I wasn't afraid of them. I felt my princely status rendered me immune from bullying.
"How do you reckon to get past the night soldiers, Charlie?" Iota asked.
"Reckon" wasn't what he said. It was what I heard.
"I don't know," I admitted.
Amit growled.
"At least not yet. How many are there, do you think, counting Kellen?"
Iota, who had been in Deep Malene for a long time, considered.
20, maybe 25 at most.
Not many of the king's guards stood with Eldin when he came back as the flight killer. Those who didn't are all dead.
Them are dead,
Amit said, meaning the night soldiers. He wasn't wrong.
Yeah, but when it's day, day in the world above, they're weaker,
Iota said.
Blue glows around them are less. You must have seen that, Charlie.
I had, but touching one, even trying, would result in a disabling shock. Iota knew that. The others would as well. And the odds were against us. Before the first round, we outnumbered them. Now, we didn't. If we waited until after the second round, there would only be 8 of us left. Less, if some were wounded as badly as Freed and Gully.
You ain't got no fucking idea,
Amit said, and waited, hopefully, I think, for me to contradict him. I couldn't, but I knew something they didn't.
Listen to me, you two, and spread the word. There is a way out.
At least there was if Percy was telling the truth.
If we can get past the night soldiers, we'll use it.
What way?
Iota asked.
Never mind that for now.
Say there is. How are we going to get past the blues?
Back to that. I'm working on it. Amit swatted a hand dangerously close to my nose.
You don't have nothing.
I didn't want to play my trump card, but I saw no choice. I ran my hands into my hair and lifted it, showing the blonde roots.
Am I the prince that was promised or not?
For that, they had no answer. Iota even put his palm to his brow. Of course, being full of food, as he was, he might just have been being generous. 2. Percy and his 2-man kitchen crew came back shortly thereafter, accompanied by a pair of night soldiers. Their blue envelopes were noticeably weaker, pastel instead of almost indigo. So somewhere above us, the sun was up, although probably hidden under the usual bank of clouds. Given a choice between another bowl of chicken stew and seeing daylight, I would have picked daylight. Easy to say when your belly's full, I thought. We put our bowls and cups in the cart. All of them shone, making me think of how Radar had licked her bowl clean in better days. Our cell doors slammed shut. Day above, but another night for us. Malene settled down with rather more burps and farts than usual, but eventually those were joined by snores. Killing is a tiring and dispiriting job. The wait to see if one will live or die is even more tiring and dispiriting. I thought of adding Hamie's pallet to my own to pad the stone floor we slept on, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. I lay looking up at the always black barred window. I was exhausted, but every time I closed my eyes, I saw either claws in that last moment when they were the eyes of a living man, or Stooks, with his hand held to his cheek to keep his stew from dribbling out. At last, I slept, and dreamed of Princess Leah by the pool, holding my mother's funky hairdryer, the purple ray gun of death. There was a purpose for that dream. Either empisarian magic, or the more ordinary magic of my subconscious trying to tell me something, but before I could get hold of it, something woke me. A rattling sound and something scraping on stone. I sat up and looked around. The dead gas jet was moving in its hole. First clockwise, then counterclock.
What?
That was Iota in the cell across from me. I put my finger to my lips.
Shh.
That was just instinct. Everyone else was asleep, a couple moaning with what were undoubtedly bad dreams, and there were certainly no listening devices, not an Empis. We watched the gas jet rock back and forth. At last, it fell out and hung by its metal hose. Something was inside. At first I thought it was a big old rat, but the shadowy shape looked too angular to be a rat. Then it squeezed through and scuttered quickly down the wall to the puddly stone floor.
What the fuck?
Iota whispered. I stared, dumbfounded, as a red cricket, as large as a tomcat, hopped its way toward me on its muscular back legs. It was still limping, but only a little. It came to the bars of my cell and looked up at me with its black eyes. The long feelers rising from its head reminded me of the rabbit ears on Mr. Bowditch's old-school TV. There was an armored plate between its eyes and a mouth that looked frozen in a fiendish grin. And there was something on its underbelly that looked like a scrap of paper. I dropped to one knee and said,
I remember you. How's the leg?
Looks better. The cricket hopped into the cell. That would have been easy for a cricket in the world I'd come from, but this one was so big it had to squeeze through. It looked at me. It remembered me. I reached out, slowly, and stroked the top of its chitinous head. As if it had been waiting for my touch, it fell on its side. There was indeed a bit of folded paper on its armored belly, stuck there with some kind of glue. Gently, I pulled it free, trying not to rip it. The cricket regained its six legs, four for walking, it looked like to me, and two big ones in the back for jumping, and leaped to Hamie's pallet, where it resumed looking at me. More magic. I was getting used to it. I unfolded the paper. The note was written in letters so tiny I had to hold it close to my face to read it. But there was something else that seemed far more important to me just then. It was a little bunch of hair, held to the note with that same gluey substance. I lifted it to my nose and smelled. The aroma was faint, but unmistakable. Radar. The note read, Are you alive? Can we help you? Please reply if you can. Dog is safe. C.
What is it?
I whispered.
What did it bring you?
I had paper, one small sheet from Percy, and the stub of pencil. I could reply, but to say what?
Charlie, what did it?
Shut up, I whispered back.
I need to think.
Can we help you? The note asked. The big question had to do with that pronoun. The note was from Claudia, of course. Somehow, probably because of Radar's sense of smell and innate direction finder, my dog had found her way to Claudia's house of sticks. That was good. That was wonderful. But Claudia lived alone. She was an I, not a we. Had Woody joined her? Perhaps even Leah, mounted on the faithful Falada? They would not be enough, royal blood or no royal blood. But if they had mustered others... The Grey Folk. Was that too much to hope for? Probably it was. Except if they really believed I was the promised prince, then maybe.
Think, Charlie, think.
What I thought of was the stadium. Once the field of the monarchs, now the field of Eldin. There was no electricity to light it, not from the rickety slave-powered generator Aaron had shown me. But lit it was, at least when the fair one was happening, by banks of jumbo gas jets mounted all around the stadium's circular rim. I had 1,000 questions and only one scrap of paper. Not an ideal situation, especially since getting any of them answered was extremely unlikely, but I also had one idea, which was better than none. The problem was it wouldn't even come close to working unless I could think of a way to neutralize the night soldiers. If I could, and if this providential red cricket, to whom I'd once done a good turn, would return a message to Claudia. I folded over my one precious scrap of paper and tore it carefully in two. Then, very small, I printed this. Alive. Watch for next night, Field of Monarchs lights up. Come if you are many, not if you are few. I thought about signing the note, as she had, C, then thought better of it. At the bottom of my half scrap, smaller than ever, I printed, not without embarrassment, Prince Charlie.
Come here,
I whispered to the cricket. It sat on Hamie's pallet without moving, the joints of its oversized back leg sticking up like bent elbows. I snapped my fingers, and it took a leap, landing in front of me. It was a hell of a lot spryer than the last time I'd seen it. I gave it a gentle push with my tented fingers, and it fell obligingly on its side. The glue stuff on its belly was still plenty sticky. I attached the note and told it,
"Go on, take it back."
The cricket got up, but didn't move. Iota was staring at it, his eyes so big they looked in danger of falling out of their sockets.
"Go,"
I whispered, and pointed at the hole above the dangling gas jet.
"Go back to Claudia."
It occurred to me that I was giving instructions to a cricket. It further occurred to me that I had lost my mind. It looked at me with its solemn black eyes for a moment or two longer, then turned and squeezed back through the bars. It hopped to the wall, felt the stone with its front legs as if testing it, then scampered up as neat as you please.
"What the fuck is that?"
Stuke said from the cell next door. I didn't bother answering him. It was red, and it was big, but if he couldn't tell it was a cricket, he was blind. The hole was a tighter squeeze than the space between my cell bars, but it got through with my note still attached. Considering who might have read the message if it had fallen to the floor, that was also excellent. Of course, there was no way of telling if it would stay on while the red cricket made its way back through whatever twists and turns had brought it here. Assuming it did, there was no way of knowing if it would still be stuck on when the cricket reached Claudia, or if it would go to her at all. But what other option did we have?
"Stooks, listen to me and pass it on. We have to wait until the second round, but before it happens, we're getting the fuck out of here."
Stooks' eyes lit up.
"How?"
"I'm still working on that. Now, leave me alone." I wanted to think. I also wanted to stroke the little bundle of hair Claudia had sent me, and wish I could stroke the dog it had come from. Yet just knowing Radar was safe had rolled a weight from my shoulders I hadn't even been aware I was carrying.
"I don't understand why that red bug came to you,"
I said.
"Is it because you're the prince?"
I shook my head. "Do you know the story about the mouse that pulled the thorn out of the lion's paw?"
"No."
"I'll tell you sometime, after we're out of here." 3. There was no playtime the next day, and no banquet either. There was breakfast, however, and because Percy was on his own, I was able to pass him a note on the other half of the paper he'd given me. There were only 5 words on it. "How go from official's room." He didn't read it, just tucked it away somewhere beneath the baggy blouse-like shirt he wore and kept rolling his cart down the corridor. The word spread. Prince Charlie has an escape plan. I hoped that if any night soldiers came to check on us, unlikely in the daytime, but it had happened, they wouldn't sense the new energy and alertness in their captive gladiators. I didn't think they would. Most of them were pretty dull, it seemed to me. But Aaron wasn't dull, and neither was the Lord High. In any case, the die was cast, always assuming Jiminy Cricket brought my note back to Claudia. When the second round came, the last heirs of the galleon might show up at the gate of the haunted city with a posse of gray folk. If we could get out of here and join them, there was a chance of freedom. Maybe even overthrow of the creature who had taken power and cursed the once pleasant land of Empis. I thought I'd settle for freedom. I didn't want to die in this damp cell or on the killing field for the pleasure of Eldon and his sycophants, and I didn't want any more of my fellow prisoners to die, either. There were only 15 of us left. Gully passed the night of the banquet, while the banquet was still going on for all I knew. Two gray men carried him off after breakfast the next morning, supervised by a night soldier whose name might have been Lemuel or Lammel, or maybe even Lemuel. It made no difference to me. I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill them all.
If there's a way to deal with the night soldiers, you better figure it out quick, Princey,
Amit said, after Gully was taken away.
I don't know about Flight Killer, but that bitch who's with him, that Petra, won't want to wait long for some more killing. She was getting off on it.
Getting off on it wasn't exactly what he said, but it wasn't wrong. Dinner the night after the banquet was chunks of half-raw pork. Just looking at mine made my stomach turn over, and I almost tossed it down the waste hole. It was good that I didn't, because there was another note from Percy tucked inside, written in that same educated script.
Move tall cabinet. Door. May be locked. Destroy this. Yours in service, Percival.
I could have used more, but that was what I had to settle for. And it would only matter if we could get to the official's room in the first place. We could deal with the limber sticks, but only if we could do something about the high voltage that surrounded our captors. But say we did. Could we kill them when they were dead already? 4. I dreaded breakfast the next day, knowing if Percy brought sausages, the second round was going to happen before I had any idea of what to do with the blue boys. But it was big flapjacks, coated with some kind of berry syrup. I caught mine, ate it, then used the cup with the hole in the bottom to wash the syrup off my hands. Iota was looking at me through the bars of his cell and licking his fingers, waiting for Percy to be gone. When he was, he said,
We've got another day for the hurt ones to heal up a little, but if it isn't tomorrow, it'll probably be the next day, 3 at most.
He was right, and they were all depending on me. Absurd for them to put their trust in a high school kid, but they needed a rainmaker, and I was elected. In my head, I heard Coach Harkness say,
Drop down and give me 20, you waste of space.
Because I had no better idea and felt like a waste of space, I did. Hands wide apart, down slow, chin touching the stone floor, then up slow.
Why you do that?
Stooks asked, hanging over the bars and watching me.
It's soothing.
After you get past the initial stiffness and the body's predictable protest at being asked to do actual work, it always is. While I went down and up, I thought about the dream. Leah holding my mother's purple hairdryer. Believing the answer to my problem, our problem, lay in a dream was undoubtedly magical thinking, but I had come to a magical place, so why not? Here's a little side note that isn't a side note at all, just wait for it. I read Dracula in the summer before 7th grade. This was also at the urging of Jenny Schuster, not long before she and her family moved to Iowa. I was going to read Frankenstein. I had it from the library, but she said it was boring, a shit ton of bad writing combined with a lot of bullshit philosophy. Dracula, she said, was 100 times better, the coolest vampire story ever written. I don't know if she was right about that. It's hard to take the literary judgments of a 12-year-old too seriously, even if she is a horror maven. But Drac was good. Yet long after all the blood-sucking, the stakes pounded into hearts, and the dead mouths stuffed with garlic had pretty much left my mind, I remembered something Van Helsing said about laughter, which he called King Laugh. He said King Laugh didn't knock, but only barged in. You know that's true if you ever saw something funny and couldn't help laughing, not just in the moment, but every time you remembered it. I think true inspiration is like that. There's no link you can put your finger on saying, oh, sure, I was thinking about this and it led me to that. Inspiration doesn't knock. I passed 20 push-ups, then 30, and just as I was about to quit, lightning struck. At one moment, the idea wasn't there. At the next, it was, and full-blown. I got up and went to the bars. I know what we're going to do. I don't know if it'll work, but there's nothing else.
Tell me,
Iota said. So I told him about my mother's hairdryer, which he didn't understand at all. Where he came from, a woman with long hair let it dry in the sun after washing. The rest of it, though, he got just fine. So did Stooks, who was listening from the cell next to mine.
Spread the word, I said, both of you.
Stooks put his palm to his forehead and bowed. The bowing stuff still gave me the creeps, but if it held them together, I'd take it until I could go back to being an ordinary kid. Except I didn't really think that was going to happen, even if I lived through this. Some changes are permanent. 5. It was sausages the next morning. Percy was usually silent as he served us, but that morning he had something to say. It was brief. Which I took to mean eat, eat. The rest of them got 3 links. I got 4, and not just because I was the Prince of Deep Malene. Tucked into each one was a wooden match with a sloppy sulfur head. I slipped 2 into one of my dirty socks and 2 into the other. I had an idea what they were for. I hoped I was right. 6. There was another agonizing wait. At last, the door opened. Aaron appeared along with Lemmel, or whatever his name was, and 2 others.
Out, kiddies,
Aaron called, spreading his arms to open the doors.
A good day for 8, a bad day for the rest. Hump, hump.
We stepped out. There was no Hatcha crying sick today. Stooks had taken care of him, although poor old Stooksy's face would never be the same. Iota looked at me with a half smile. 1 eyelid flicked in what could have been a wink. I took some courage from that. Also from knowing that whether we were able to escape or not, Eldon, Flight Killer, Petra, and his crew of suckasses were going to be cheated of their fair one. As I started to pass Aaron, he held me back with the point of his limber stick against the ragged remains of my shirt. The semi-transparent human face on top of his skull was smiling.
You think you're special, don't you? You bain't. The others think you're special, don't they? They'll learn better.
Traitor, I said. Traitor to all you swore.
The smile disappeared from what was left of his humanity. Beneath it, the skull grinned its eternal grin. He raised his limber stick, meaning to bring it down on my face, splitting it from hairline to chin. I stood, waiting for it, even turning my face up a little to receive the blow. Something else had spoken through me, and it had spoken true words. Aaron lowered his stick.
Nah, nah. I'll not mark you. I'll leave that for whoever puts paid to you. Hump now, before I decide to hug you and make you shit in your britches.
He wouldn't, though. I knew it, and Aaron did too. The 2nd round matches had been set, and he couldn't afford to mess up the seedings by giving me a shock that might render me unconscious or even kill me. I followed the others, and he brought his switch down on my thigh, cutting into my pants. The initial sting was followed by burning pain and a flow of blood. I didn't make a sound. Wouldn't give the dead son of a bitch the satisfaction. 7. We were taken to the same team room, 2 doors down from the officials' room that might be a way out. The poster board was set up in the middle of the room, as it had been before, only this time with fewer matches. Fair one, 2nd round. 1st set. Akka to Gully, deceased. Charlie to Jaya. Murph to Freed. 2nd set. Bendo to Bolt. Kamet to Stooks. Eris to Quilly, Double to Measle. Third set. Amit to Iota. So this time the big boys were scheduled for the final match. I thought it would have been a good one too, but no matter how the next few minutes turned out, it wasn't going to happen. The Lord High was waiting for us, as he had before the first round, decked out in his fancy uniform. To me, it looked like something that might have been worn by the dictator of a poor Central American country on a state occasion.
"Here we are again," he buzzed. "Some of you a little banged up, but no doubt ready and eager for battle. What do you say?"
"Yes, Lord High," I said. "Yes, Lord High," the others echoed. He looked at my bleeding thigh.
"You look a trifle banged up already, Prince Charlie."
I said nothing. He surveyed the others.
"Isn't that what you call him, Prince Charlie?"
"No, Lord High," Amit said. "He's just a little horse son who likes to put on airs."
Kellen liked that. His human lips smiled a little. Beneath it, the frozen grin just went on and on. He returned his attention to me.
"'Tis said the true prince can float and change his shape. Can you float?"
"No, Lord High," I said.
"Change your shape?"
"No."
He raised his limber stick, which was thicker and longer than those held by his troops.
"No what?"
"No, Lord High."
"Better. I'll give you kiddies a bit of time to ready yourselves,"
Kellen said.
"Cleanse yourself for your betters. Please do, and consider today's order of battle as you wash. Wet your hair and pull it back. They'll want to see your faces. I expect you to put on a good show for His Majesty, as you did in the first round. Understood?"
"Yes, Lord High," we said, just like a good little first grade class should. It swept those bottomless eyes over us again, as if he suspected something was up. Maybe he did. Then he left, followed by the others.
"Look at this," Akka gloated. "Me against a dead man. I should be able to win that one, all right."
"Today all of us are going to win, or none of us are," I said. I looked at the shelf where 16 washing buckets were lined up. Yes, they had even put one out for Gully.
"Fucking true," I growled.
"Jaya and Eris, either side of the door. Those two buckets have to be full to the top if they're not already. The rest of you, take buckets, but get down, on your hands and knees."
"Why do that?"
Bendo asked. I thought of an old grammar school joke then. Adam and Eve on the verge of having sex for the first time. "Stand back, honey," Adam says. "I don't know how big this thing gets."
"Because I don't know what's going to happen." And because, I thought, you never use a hairdryer when you're taking a bath.
My mother told me that.
Out loud, I said, "We're going to cleanse, all right, but not ourselves. This is going to work." It sounded good, but I wasn't sure. The only thing I was sure of was that when it happened, it was going to happen fast. 8.
"I hear footsteps," Eris whispered. "They're coming."
"Wait until they get inside," I said. "They won't see you. They'll be looking straight ahead."
I hoped. The two women raised their buckets to their chests. The rest of us were crouched on our hands and knees, each with a full bucket of wash water close at hand. Amit and Iota hulked protectively over me, on either side. The door opened. It was the same pair of night soldiers who, days ago, had escorted the first set out for the first round. I'd been hoping for Kellen, or Aaron, but wasn't surprised. Those two would be out on the field, ready to manage the festivities. The night soldiers stopped, looking at the line of us crouched on the floor. One said,
"What are you doing?"
I shouted,
"Now!"
Jaya and Eris doused them. As I've said, I didn't know what might happen, but I never imagined what actually did. They exploded. There was a pair of brilliant flashes that whited out my vision for a moment. I heard something, no, several somethings, whoosh over my head, and a burn like a bee sting drilled into my upper arm. I heard a high-pitched scream, a war cry, from either Jaya or Eris. My head was down, and I didn't see which one. It was followed by several yells of startled pain from either side of me.
"Up!"
I shouted. At that point, I wasn't clear on what had happened, but we had to get out of there. That much I totally understood. The detonations of the night soldiers hadn't been loud, more like the thuds heavy furniture would make when dropped on a rug, but the woman's war cry had been plenty loud. Plus, there was a rattle of shrapnel. As I got to my feet, I saw there was something sticking out of Iota's forehead, above his left eye. Blood was dribbling down the side of his nose. It was a shard of bone. There was another one in my arm. I plucked it out and dropped it. Several others had sustained injuries, but no one looked incapacitated except for Freed, and he pretty much was already. Murph, who was supposed to be his opponent in the first set, was supporting him. Iota picked the piece of bone out of his forehead and stared around, unbelieving. Shards of bone were everywhere. They looked like broken crockery. All that remained of the night soldiers were their uniforms, which were shredded, as if they had sustained close-range blasts from shotguns loaded with birdshot. A hand curled around my neck, and Amit, unwounded, pulled me into a rough hug.
"If you hadn't told us to get down, we would have been cut to pieces."
And he put a kiss on my cheek.
"How did you know?"
I didn't. The only thing I'd been thinking was that I wanted us crouched and ready to charge, like the front line of a football team.
"Everybody out. Bring your buckets. I and Amit, you lead. We're going to the official's room 2 doors up. If more night soldiers come, you two douse them and then drop to the floor. Everyone drops to the floor. But try not to spill your buckets. Now we know what happens."
As we went out with our buckets, Eris kicked aside one of the shredded uniforms, then spit on it. I took one look behind me. The team room, where we were supposed to wait until it came our turn to fight, was now a boneyard. Good. 9. Amit and Iota led the way. Eris grabbed the late Gully's bucket to replace hers. Jaya, her bucket now empty, brought up the rear. Just as we reached the door to the official's room, 2 more night soldiers came humping down the corridor from the brightly lit field.
"Oi!"
one of them cried. I'm pretty sure it was oi.
"What are you lot doing out? It's just supposed to be the first set."
Amit and Iota stopped. We all stopped. Amit, sounding beautifully confused.
"And it's supposed to be all of us this time, to salute His Majesty."
They came closer.
"First set only, you dummocks,"
the other said.
"The rest of you back into the—"
Amit and Iota looked at each other. I nodded. They took a step forward in perfect tandem, as if it had been planned, threw their buckets of water, and dropped. The rest of us were already down, this time not merely crouching, but on our bellies. We had been immensely lucky the first time. We might not be again. These 2 also exploded. In addition to the flashes and the thudding sounds, I heard a kind of electrical crackling, like a small transformer just before an excessive power load fries it, and I caught a whiff of ozone. Clouds of bone flew over us, rattling off the walls and bouncing along the floor. Amit got up and turned to me, all his teeth showing in a grin that was beyond fierce. It was fiendish.
"Let's all of us run out there, Charlie. We got almost 12 more buckets. Let's blow up as many of those fucks as we can."
"Not at all. We'd get some and then they'd massacre us. We're escaping, not fighting."
Amit's blood was up and all the way.
I didn't think he was going to listen to me, but I grabbed his neck and gave him a shake.
Who's the prince, asshole? You or him?
Him.
That's right. And we do what he says.
Come on, I said. Bendo, Bolt, buckets full?
Half, Bolt said. I regret to say I spilled it on my prince.
Get ahead of us, facing the mouth of the runway. Double you and Kamet too. If more come...
We'll give him a bath, right so, Kamet said.
I led the rest of them, swinging my own bucket. I'd also lost some water. My pants legs were wet, but the bucket was still 3/4 full. The door to the official's room was locked.
Amit, I, see what you can do.
They hit the door together. It burst open. It was dim inside, and the afterimage of the explosions hanging in front of my eyes didn't help.
Who can see? I shouted. There's a tall cabinet. Who can see?
One of our rear guard shouted then. A moment later, there was a brilliant flash. By its light, I saw the cabinet standing against the far wall, flanked by half a dozen wooden chairs. There was a howl of pain, then a second brilliant flash. Bendo, Double, and Kamet came in, Kamet bleeding heavily from his face and arm. There were bone fragments sticking out of both wounds like yellowish-white quills.
Got two more, Bendo panted. But the second one dead for Bolt before I got him. Pulled him into a hug. He started shaking.
So we'd lost one. But if Bendo was right, the Night Soldiers had lost six. Not a bad score, but there were still plenty of others.
Aye, help me move this cabinet.
I didn't get a chance to help. I strode to the cabinet, which looked like my Nana's Welsh dresser. He put his shoulder to it and gave a mighty push. It slid 4 feet, tottered, and fell over with a crash. There was a door behind it, just as Percy's note had promised. There were shouts, buzzy shouts, from somewhere, still distant but alarmed. I didn't know if the Lord High had guessed his prisoners were trying to escape, but he and his cadre of night soldiers had to know something was up. Stooks lifted the latch of the door and pulled it open. That surprised me, but also gave me hope. Door may be locked, Percy's note had said. Not maybe, but may be. I hoped I was right about what he meant.
Go, I said, all of you.
They crowded in, Murph still supporting Freed. My vision was clearing a little now, and I saw a torpedo-shaped lantern sitting on one of the wooden chairs. I mentally blessed Percival, with many blessings. If they discovered he'd helped us, it would go badly for him if the escape failed. Maybe if it didn't. Iota backed out.
It's fucking dark in here, Charlie.
He saw the lantern.
Oh, if only we had out to light it with.
I put down my bucket, reached into my sock, and produced a sulfur match. I stared at it, then at me, with amazement.
You really are the prince.
I handed him the match. Maybe, but I don't know how this works. You do it. While he was lighting the lamp, its glass reservoir was filled with either kerosene or something similar, running steps came toward us from the field.
Oi! Oi! What's going on in there?
I knew that voice, insect buzz or not.
Why is that door open?
Iota looked at me and raised his hands, lit lamp in one, the other empty. No bucket.
Get in there,
I said.
Pull the door shut. I think it locks on the inside.
I don't want to leave you.
Go!
He went. Aaron appeared in the door, his blue aura pulsing so bright it was hard to look at. And there I was, with a bucket dangling from one hand. He stopped, momentarily too startled by what he was seeing, to move.
Should have kept coming, I thought. I took a step forward and threw the bucket of water at him.
I saw it, in the air, as if in slow motion, a big, amorphous crystal. The skull under Aaron's skin continued to grin, but on what remained of his human face, I saw shocked surprise. I had just time to think of the Wicked Witch of the West screeching,
I'm melting! I'm melting!
He dropped his damned limber stick and raised one arm as if to block what was coming. I went flat just before the brilliant detonation sent Aaron into what I sincerely hoped
was a hellish afterlife. Bones flew above me, but not all of them passed harmlessly. This time it wasn't a bee sting in the arm, but lines of pain along my scalp and across my left shoulder. I got to my feet, staggered, and turned to the door. I could hear others coming now. I wished for more water, and there was a sink on the far side of the room, but there was no time. I lifted the latch and pulled, expecting the door to be locked. It wasn't. I went in, closed it, and grabbed the lantern by its wooden handle. I lowered it and saw two bolts. They looked sturdy. I hoped to God they were. Just as I shot the second one, I saw the inner latch lift and the door began to rattle in its frame. I stepped back. The door was wood, not metal, but I still didn't want to risk getting shocked.
Open! Open in the name of Elden Flightkiller!
Kiss my asshole in the name of Elden Flightkiller,
somebody said from behind me. I turned. By the lantern's paltry glow, I could see all 13 of them. We were in a square corridor, lined with white tiles. It made me think of a subway tunnel. There were unlit gas jets at head height, marching away into the gloom. My fellow prisoners, ex-prisoners, at least for the time being, were all looking at me, eyes wide, and except for Amit and Iota, they all looked scared. They were waiting, God help me, for Prince Charlie to lead them. Hammering on the door, through the cracks at the sides and bottom, bright blue light. Leading was easy enough, at least for the moment, because there was only one way to go. I pushed through them, holding up the lantern, feeling absurdly like Lady Liberty with her torch. Something occurred to me, then, a line from a war movie I'd seen on TCM. It was out of my mouth before I knew I was going to say it. I suppose I was either hysterical or inspired.
Come on, you sons of bitches! Do you want to live forever?
Amit laughed and clapped me on the back, so hard I almost dropped the lantern, which would have left us in what the old-timey horror novels like to call the living dark. I started walking. They followed. The hammering on the door faded, then was left behind. Kellen's night soldiers would have a hell of a hard job breaking it down, too, because it opened outward, and because inside their auras, there really wasn't much to them, as we now knew. God bless Percival, whose note hadn't been timid, as I had first thought. It had been an invitation. The door may be locked, as in behind you.
Who wants to live forever?
Iota roared, and a flat echo came back from the tiles.
I do,
Jaya piped up. And you may not believe it, but we laughed. All of us. Chapter 26. The Tunnel and the Station. Scratching. The Trolley House. Red Molly. The Welcoming Party. A Mother's Grief. 1. I think the tunnel was a little over a mile and a half long from the officials' room to where we finally emerged, but at the time, with only a single lantern to lead us, it seemed to go on forever. It tended always upward, broken every now and again by short flights of stairs, 6 in one, 8 in another, 4 in a third. Then it took a square turn to the right, and there were more steps, this time a longer flight. By then, Murph could no longer support Freed, so Amit was carrying him. When I made it to the top, I paused to get my wind back and Amit caught up to me. Not breathing hard at all, either, curse him.
Freed says he knows where this comes out, Amit said. Tell him.
Freed looked up at me. In the pale glow of the lantern, his face was a horror of lumps, bruises, and cuts. Those he might recover from, but the leg wound was infected. I could smell it.
He sometimes came with the officials in the old days, Freed said. The judges and boundary men. To doctor the cuts and breaks and broken heads, you understand? It wasn't like the fair one, murder for the sake of murder, but...
A word I couldn't translate.
Was plenty rough.
The rest of our merry band was bunched below us on the stairs. We couldn't afford to stop, but I needed to know what was ahead, so I cranked my fist at the dock, telling him to go on, but to make it fast.
We didn't use the tunnel to come to the Field of the Monarchs, but we often used it when we left. Always if Empus lost because of calls that enraged the crowd.
Kill the ump, I said.
Eh?
Never mind. Where does it come out?
The trolley house, of course.
Freed managed a feeble smile.
Because, you must understand, when Empus lost a match, it was wise to leave the city as soon as possible.
How close is this trolley house to the main gate? Freed said what I wanted to hear and feared I would not.
Quite close.
Let's go, I said. I almost added hump hump, but didn't. That was the language of our captors, and I wanted none of their belittling talk. We'd done for 7 of them. No matter how it went at the end of the tunnel, there was that. Who still has buckets with water in them? I called back. 6 did, but none were full. I asked them to come up behind me. We'd use what we had, then do what we could. 2. We came to another flight of steps, and Amit, out of breath at last by the time we got to the top of them, shifted Freed to Iota. Freed said,
Leave me. I'm just dead weight.
Save your breath to cool your porridge,
I growled. It might have been porridge, as in the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It might have been soup. The corridor now tended up more steeply, like the one leading to the field. I hoped we'd reach the end soon because the reservoir of fuel in the lantern was almost gone, and the light was dimming. Then, on our right, I began to hear a scratching and scrabbling beyond the tile wall. Quite close. I remembered my doomed run for the outer gate, tripping over the gravestones, and the hackles on my neck rose.
What's that? Quilly asked. It sounds like...
He didn't finish, but we all knew what it sounded like. Fingers. Fingers in the earth, clawing toward the sound of our passage.
I don't know what it is,
I said, which was probably a lie. Eris said,
When his mind is not at rest, Eldon, I mean, the dead grow restless. So I've heard. It might only be a story to scare children. Even if it's true, I don't think they can get in here.
I wasn't so sure about that. I'd seen hands rising from the ground, the dead reaching into the living world. And I'd also heard the squall of rusty hinges as though something were emerging from the crypts and tombs, maybe several somethings.
Rats is all.
That was Measle. He was trying to sound authoritative.
Maybe voles or ferrets. Anything else. Just stories to frighten children, like she says.
I didn't really think they could get through the tile wall between us and them, but I was still grateful when we left the scratching behind. If it had been the graveyard, I had at least a rough idea of where we were, and if I was right, we were indeed close to the gate. As we reached another flight of stairs, steep and long, the lantern began to gutter.
Leave me. Leave me, Freed moaned. I'm done.
Shut up or I'll do you myself,
I panted, and started up the stairs with Freed in his arms. I followed and the rest followed me. At the top was a little room with benches on either side and a door. It was locked, and this time not on the inside. That would have been too easy. The handle was a rusty lever. Amit seized it, turned it, and pulled with all his might. It broke off.
Fuck!
He dropped it and examined his bleeding hand.
Oi, get with me, right beside me, and hump it!
I passed Doc Freed to Kamet and Quilly, then crowded in beside Amit, shoulder to shoulder. The flame inside the lantern gave a final jump, like a dying man's last gasp. For a moment, I could see our shadows on the white tiles, and then we were plunged into utter darkness. Jaya moaned.
With me, Amit snarled. On 3, hit it as damn it hard as you ever hit anything in your damn it life. 1, 2, 3!
For a moment, there was a bit of light as the door shuddered in its frame. Then we were in the dark again.
Oh, you can hit harder than that, you fucking...
Pussy? Cunt? I heard both, overlapping.
On 3. 1, 2, 3!
The door's bolts must have been sturdy because they held. It was the hinges that gave way, sending the door flying back. Iota and Amit stumbled out. I went to his knees and Amit hauled him to his feet. The rest of us followed.
"Thank the high gods,"
Akka cried. His voice echoed back from some vast space.
"Ankh, Ankh,"
and
"Odds, Odds."
A moment later, we were enveloped in a cloud of leathery wings. 3. Eris and Jaya shrieked in perfect harmony. They weren't the only ones to cry out. I think most of us yelled or screamed in terror. I know I did. I dropped the lantern to cover my head and heard it shatter on the stone floor.
"Bats,"
Freed wheezed.
"Just bats. They roost."
He began to cough and couldn't finish, but pointed up into the deep shadows. Amit heard him and bellowed it.
"Bats! They won't hurt ye! Stand your ground and swat 'em away!"
We swung our arms, me hoping they weren't vampire bats because they were huge, like the ones in the tunnel between Illinois and Empus. I could glimpse them as they swooped and turned, because faint light, I think cloud-shrouded moonlight, was coming through a line of small, high windows. I could see most of the others, all waving their arms madly. Kamet and Quilly were carrying Freed, so they couldn't swat, but Doc himself was waving his arms feebly and coughing up a storm. The colony swooped away, back to the heights of the enormous room in which we found ourselves. This part of the trolley house appeared to be a garage. There were at least 20 trolleys in neat rows. Painted on their blunt snouts were their destinations: Seafront, Disk, Ullum, Tevo North, Tevo South, Green Isles. The posts on their roofs, meant to draw power from the overhead wires, most of those now down in the streets, hung limp and dispirited. On the sides of the ones I could see, in gold flake, were words decidedly out of vogue in Empus these days. Friendship, amity, kindness, and love.
"How do we get out?"
Stooks asked. Eris said,
"Did you never learn to read?"
"As well as any ploughboy, I guess,"
Stooks said, sounding grumpy. Of course, I'd be grumpy too if I had to hold my cheek with my hand to keep the food from squirting out.
"Read that, then,"
Eris said, pointing above a high central arch on the far side of the garage. Printed above it was "Way Out." We went through the arch, 13 would-be escapees falling in behind their clueless prince. We came out in a room almost as big as the garage, with a row of what had to be ticketing stations on one side and a number of smaller arches with destinations painted over them on the other. The glass of the ticket windows had been shattered, a giant butterfly centerpiece had been broken to bits, and a mural of monarchs had been splashed with paint. But the vandals hadn't been able to deface all the butterflies. High above, running all around the room, were bright yellow tiles with a monarch on each one. Seeing what Eldon's cronies hadn't been able to destroy brought me comfort. And if I was right, there might be something I could use nearby. "Come on," I said, and pointed to a bank of doors. I broke into a run. 4. We burst into the outside world, a few still swinging buckets. We huddled at the top of the steps leading down to the Galleon Road, Kamet and Quilly grunting as they carried Freed between them. I heard the clang of the Lord High's squat bus and saw a dozen or so night soldiers running in front of it, spread out across the wide thoroughfare. I had thought Kellen's little vehicle might be the only motorized transport left in Lillimar, but I was wrong. There was one ahead of the night soldiers leading the pack, and unlike the bus, it wasn't powered by electricity. It blatted and backfired as it came toward us. Enormous handlebars jutted from the front of a board wagon. 4 iron-bound wheels struck sparks from the cobbles. At the front, adding to whatever power the wagon's motor was supplying, was Red Molly, sitting on a high seat and pedaling for all she was worth. Her huge knees flashed up and down. She was bent over the handlebars like a daredevil motorcycle rider.
We might have been able to beat the rest to the gate, but she was coming fast. I saw red and white striped posts. I saw the down snarl of trolley wires I'd almost tripped over, and I saw the nest of brambles into which I'd thrown my pack so I could run a little faster. I hadn't made it that time, and I wasn't going to make it this time either. None of us were. Unless that pack was still there.
That bitch! I'll take her on!
Iota growled, bawling his fists.
I'll stand with you,
Amit said.
I will, or damn it!
No, I said. I was thinking of Woody's nephew, Aloysius, and how Red Molly's mother had swatted his head from his shoulders.
Wait.
But I can...
I grabbed his shoulder. She hasn't seen us yet. She's looking straight ahead. I've got something. Trust me. I looked at the others. Stay here, all of you. Hunching low, I ran down the steps. The blatting, burping motor wagon was now close enough for me to see Red Molly's features, but she was still looking straight ahead, squinting, maybe nearsighted, and expecting to see the crowd of us running for the gate. I could have caught her by surprise, maybe, but then a small figure dressed in green britches with the seat torn out, ran into the street, waving its arms.
He's there!
Peterkin screeched, pointing directly at me. How had he seen us? Had he been waiting? I never knew, and I never gave a shit either. That pipsqueak fuck had a way of turning up at the worst possible moment.
He's there! Right there!
Pointing, leaping up and down in his excitement.
Do you not see him, you great half-blind bitch? He's right there!
She never slowed, simply leaned down and swatted him. Peterkin rose into the air. I caught one glimpse of his face, stamped with a terminal expression of shocked surprise, and then he separated at the middle. Red Molly's blow had been strong enough to literally rip him in two. He must have risen 20 feet in the air, intestines uncoiling as he went. I thought of Rumpelstiltskin again, was powerless not to. Red Molly was grinning, and the grin revealed teeth filed to points. They hadn't found my backpack, thank God. It was still in the brambles. Thorn scrawled cuts up my bare arms as I pulled it out. I didn't feel them. One of the straps holding the pack closed slid out easily, the other bound up. I tore it away and pulled out cans of sardines, a jar of Jif, a spaghetti sauce jar filled with dog food, a shirt, my toothbrush, a pair of undershorts. Iota grabbed my shoulder. My little band of water warriors had followed him down the steps against my orders, but that was for the best after all. I take them and run. Carry Freed yourself. The ones who still have water, they're your rear guard. At the gate, shout open in the name of Leah of the Galleon. Can you remember?
Yeah.
You die now,
Red Molly screamed. Her voice was a deep baritone powered by mighty lungs.
Then go!
I waved one meaty arm at the others.
Come on, you lot! Hump it for your lives!
Most did. Amit didn't. He had apparently appointed himself my guardian. There was no time to argue with him. I found Polly's 22 and yanked it free, along with a few more cans of sardines and a package of Nabisco honeygrams that I didn't even remember packing. Red Molly stopped, 30 feet from the trolley house steps, and scrambled down from her high seat, one arm sodden to the elbow with Peterkin's blood. Amit placed himself in front of me, which was a problem unless I intended to shoot him in the head. I shoved him aside.
Get out of here, Amit!
He paid no attention, only threw himself at Red Molly with a bellow of rage. He was a big man, but next to the giant, he looked not much larger than Peterkin, now lying dead in two pieces up the street. For a moment, she was too surprised by this unexpected attack to move. Amit took advantage while he could. He grabbed one of her wide suspenders and pulled himself up one-handed. He opened his mouth and buried his teeth in her arm, just above the elbow. She screeched in pain, grabbed him by his greasy mop of hair and pulled his head away. She balled up a fist and drove it not into his face, but through it. His eyes bulged
in two different directions as if not wanting to see the red hole that had been his nose and mouth. She lifted him still with only one hand and shook that big man to and fro like a marionette. Then she threw him in the direction of the graveyard, blood fanning up from her bitten arm. Amit was brawny and fearless, but she had disposed of him as if he had been no more than a child. Next, she turned to me. I was sitting on the cobbled pavement of the Galleon Road, legs splayed, Polly's .22 automatic held out in both hands. I remembered how it had felt to have that gun pressed into the back of my head. I thought again of Rumpelstiltskin and how much Polly had reminded me of that fairy tale dwarf. What will you give me if I spin your straw into gold? Polly would have killed me once he got Mr. Bowditch's treasure and tumbled me down the magic well hidden in Mr. Bowditch's shed. Mostly, I remember hoping that the little gun would stop a giant, just as David's little stone had stopped Goliath. It might, if it was mostly loaded. It had been fired twice already, back in a less magical world. She came toward me, grinning. Her wounded arm was pouring blood. She didn't seem to mind. Maybe Amit's final bite would start an infection that would kill her if I couldn't.
"You're no prince,"
she said in that rumbling baritone.
"You're a bug. Nothing but a bug. I'll just step on you and..."
I fired. The gun gave a polite bang, not much louder than the Daisy air rifle I'd had when I was 6 years old. A small black hole appeared over Red Molly's right eye. She reared back, and I shot her again. This time the hole appeared in her throat, and when she gave a howl of pain, blood jetted from the hole. It came out under so much pressure that it looked solid, like the shaft of a red arrow. I fired again, and this time the black hole, not much bigger than the period you put at the end of a sentence, appeared at the top of her nose. None of it stopped her.
"No!"
she screamed and reached for me. I didn't pull back or even try to dodge. That would have fucked up my aim, and it was far too late to run.